Ask the committee to pick up lunch.
Gil, will these slides be made available to us?
We're making these slides available.
Sure. Gil, can we follow up with one question from our committee? Because that wasn't an open session when we met before.
Yes.
So, Lisa, one question that I'd like to revisit with you very quickly is, in those three Duke prospective clinical trials, based on the insights that you've provided to us throughout, pointing out the importance that for the most reliable level of validation, it should come from a clinical trial where the study was conducted, the outcomes are recorded according to good clinical practice in a locked clinical database, where that database is kept confidential from the investigators. Do you have any insights as to whether or not that process was followed in those three Duke clinical trials?
I'm aware of allegations that they were not followed in at least one of the trials. And Duke officials are aware of that and have investigated. I don't know the details of exactly what was found in the investigation, but that is a real issue because we really rely on prospective trials to have accurately collected data. So that even if we went into a trial with a predictor that we weren't totally sure of, but we were willing to use it as long as the results weren't returned to the patients or used in any way to guide the therapy, that we would at least hope that the trial would answer the question. So if you cannot rely on the data in the trial having been collected in a way that is free of errors, free of potential manipulation, that is a very serious problem.
And given the seriousness of this problem, due to the nature of how this information was provided to you, is it not possible for you to tell us more? And if it's not possible, then is the obvious thing for us to do to pursue this with those Duke investigators?
Yeah, I mean, I would urge you to first try and get the information from Duke because they will know not only what the allegations were, but whether they have been able to confirm or refute the allegations. And some issues of things like data potentially having been accessible to people who should not have access to it. Just because there was a potential there doesn't necessarily mean there were actual alterations or that the information was used in any inappropriate way. So they would really be able to give you the full picture. Rob Califf is the one you should talk to. I know for a fact that he's well aware of this. In terms of our releasing the information that I received, there's quite frankly a lot of detail in there. Names named, very troubling accusations made, and I would prefer not to release that because it's so sensitive. But if you have no success getting it from Duke, I certainly can take it to the NCI leadership, and we can decide what we think we could release or is appropriate or legally able to release. But I say there's very sensitive information in there.
Okay, Al?
Yes, I can just have one quick follow-up question to Tom's. And we had a little discussion this morning, and we're not going to assume that the answer is no, but just in the event that we do make the inquiry to Duke, and they're either unwilling or unable to provide us with information, do you believe that based on or discussion this morning and based on your understanding, we have enough information or sufficient information at this point that could lead us to achieve reasonable recommendations to be helpful to the scientific field? Not necessarily to Duke per se, but to the scientific field. As I said, we think that it's important that we get this information, but there's always that possibility that based on a variety of maybe legal counsel or sensitivity, we may not. What do you think about the sufficiency of the information that we have thus far? Is it adequate to make certain scientific guidelines?
Well, I think that if the allegations turn out to be true, that standard clinical trials practice, if it had been in place, would have avoided the problems. And better understanding of regulatory issues and oversight in terms of what regulatory processes have to be followed, would have addressed and prevented any of those things that were alleged. So the FDA, for example, has a guidance document on how you should appropriately maintain clinical data in electronic formats. You know, things like you have to have logins to, so you know exactly who was accessing the data, who made any change to the data, so that you have an audit trail. And those are the kinds of things that have been put in place because bad things can happen if they aren't in place. And for therapy trials, this would be routine. You know, I think that there hasn't been the recognition that if you are developing a device that could have an impact on the patient's outcome because it influenced what therapy they got, there hasn't been the recognition that that can be as important as what therapy you give the person. It really should not be a set of two different standards. That, you know, these are things that will impact on the patient's care and outcome, and you need to have every bit as much rigor in those kinds of trials as you do for therapy trials.
I think it's ironic that there's been so much discussion that the new omics kind of exploratory analysis is unfamiliar to some people, a lot of people, and is considered to be complex and therefore needs to be developed through special genomics entities, whether companies or departments or divisions or centers or institutes. And then people lose track that if you're going to do clinical trials, there is a very well-established structure, process, oversight, rules, and regulations, and standards of performance for clinical trials, all kinds of clinical trials. And maybe one of the biggest recommendations we have to make is that new technology platforms need to be brought into existing, preferably existing well-run, clinical trials operations.
Yeah, following up on that comment, I was going to say that your last comment suggests that it's really not an issue of the omics-based test, but rather just standard clinical practice was not carried out, at least in the situation that we're discussing. So can you distinguish then in that case versus just what omics, you know, other things that should be followed in addition to just best clinical practice if you're going to use an omics test?
Well, I think that the complexity of some of the omics classifiers, you know, make it more difficult to evaluate the body of evidence that leads up to your wanting to run a trial, and that somehow that has become confused with how you should run the trial once you get there. And I think it's also an issue of the different types of expertise that are involved in the development of omics versus early phase clinical trials, that I've seen, you know, I've sat on study sections for other places, not NIH, and you'll see grant applications coming in where they'll have funding either for a bioinformatician or a statistician, but not both often. And that can be a huge mistake if you're really trying to move that omics predictor into something that would be clinically useful. And, you know, both of those are crucially important people, but you shouldn't assume that you know, somebody's a jack of all trades and can do both. I mean, I certainly don't consider myself any kind of bioinformatics expert or even computational expert, but I do have basic understanding of clinical trials, and I know a little bit about the omics. So you need to get the right people in there, and you need to have the institutions and perhaps even the funding agencies recognize the importance of having all of that kind of expertise involved. You know, it's going to cost more money to have both a statistician and a bioinformatician. And in terms of staffing at an institution, I have seen, and I'd love to hear Dave's and Tom's comments on this as senior clinical trials people, that I have seen biostatistics departments almost overrun with people doing computational biology and bioinformatics. And again, those are extremely important. We need them in this, but they're not the same as a classically trained biostatistician who knows clinical trials methodology. And it's become a real problem. And we have a terrible time, and I bet some of you who work in the cooperative groups could confirm this, even trying to find people who have statisticians who have clinical trials expertise anymore. There's always been a shortage of biostatisticians, and it's gotten even worse because now we're spreading them even more thinly across bioinformatics, computational biology, and clinical trials statistics.
So I was wondering if I could ask your opinion on something that's related to that. So we've looked at the Duke papers, and we've seen who are the specific co-authors who seem to have statistical expertise. And there's sort of this feeling, like Mike West was on one of the papers, other people were on other papers, where were they? But as someone who's really involved in a lot of these omics studies, there is not an expectation that if you're a biostatistician on an omics paper, that you're responsible for every inch of the way. And that's something that really, it seems to me, although I don't know a lot about clinical trials, is fundamentally different. Like, Tom, I would imagine if you're the biostatistician on a clinical trial, you're 100% behind every little thing. And that's not what it's like to be a statistician on an omics paper. So I was wondering what you think about that and if that's something we should somehow be addressing.
Yeah, I think that's a real issue. I think that was a problem in this. I think that there were people responsible for their different parts. And if, for example, Bill Barry was writing the R code to be used in the trial, he took what was handed to him in the way of data and possibly also, code. But I don't know that he had a way of verifying that what he was being given was correct.
Okay. Just
one comment. Take that to its logical conclusion. Since the ovarian cancer TCGA paper came out today or yesterday or wherever it was, I mean, the analytical group that contributed to that paper was at least 100 people.
Yeah.
And I can promise you that there is nobody in the universe that knows all there is to know about the computational biology that went into that paper. It is beyond the capability of any human to actually span that entire intellectual space. And so, one of the things that we have to get to is some understanding of what we can realistically do with some of these data. And
right. No, that's true. But I guess it speaks again to the fact that maybe because of all that complexity and the fact that no one person is going to know all the pieces, it just maybe makes it even more important that we do things like external validations before we move things into clinical trials.
I actually want to second that. Joe, I take your point that no one probably knows the full complexity of any large-scale analysis. But if you pull out 10 genes and say you've got a predictive model that will tell us something about outcome in ovarian cancer, then that piece is something which could easily be validated.
Well, I think it's very important for the relevance going forward of our report, since our examples are cases of early stage microarrays, mammoprint from a decade ago, Oncotype DX, which is a totally different kind of a panel with various phenotypes represented by subsets of markers, and the OVA1, which is 5 abundant acute phase reactant proteins. I mean, these are so primitive compared to next-gen sequencing and TCGA that we have to include some text in this report under the S&T section about what is emerging and what kinds of capabilities, strategies, expectations should apply to these really new generation molecular studies, because that's where the field is going. And omics-based predictive tests is a pretty good phrase. It means from whatever combination of candidates and vast, unbiased global analysis, we pull out a panel and justify it and then demonstrate that it's appropriately used for clinical utility.
Gil, do you think the concepts will change with the new technology, or aren't the concepts the same about hypothesis testing, external validity?
Well, this whole big question about bioinformatics and biostatistics is what.
Well, but the answer to the question,
because that was not a huge issue when you're dealing with three gene products.
But the answer that John Quackenbush and Lisa discussed was that's why if people can't understand it, that's all the more reason for external validation. Isn't that going to be a similar principle that's going to help us out in the future for any technology?
Well, I don't like relying on external validation or any other kind of validation. I think the initial design, the data collection, as you said in your first couple slides, the structuring of the analysis, all that is so much more important than trying to figure out what happened afterwards by matching up. But I'm sure you'd make the same point.
But Gil, this is John. You can say that, but let's say I do a very complex analysis, and I have a set of genes and some algorithm that I've developed that I claim is predictive. It's very easy. You don't have to reconstruct all of the other analysis, right? I mean, this is what happened with the example Lisa gave early on with the signature at Duke. If you take that signature, if you take that methodology, and you apply it to an independent data set, it either is going to stand on its own two legs or not. If it stands on its own two legs, then you don't need to go back and understand how it was pulled out. If it is still highly predictive in a new, completely independent data set, where it came from, whether it was intuition or, you know, careful data analysis, almost doesn't matter.
So actually, this is Dan Hayes. David Rantoff and I had exactly this email conversation about 18 months ago, where I said, I don't care if it works, it works. And one of the reasons I didn't care is the Bonnefoy study looked to me like an external validation. We now find out that the Bonnefoy data were not external because the clinical data were handed to the guys.
But if it works, that would have proved the point. And that's why everybody was paid so much attention.
This is why I argued against you. You won the argument in the long run here. But I think, again, this is an important point of what went wrong in the sequence here was the external validation has to be done independently. The assays can still be done at the original site because maybe they have the expertise. Right. But the association with the clinical outcomes has to be blinded.
So at least to make the point here, that there are unidentified differences that generate these batch effects from different places, the way samples are handled. There is heterogeneity among patients who are classified identically. And I'm a little worried that this notion you should get identical results on a totally new patient population that happens to be the same stage and same diagnosis is not credible.
Actually, I strongly disagree. Context of use. So that if you were going to do a laboratory experiment and you got results with three breast cancer lines that looked good, and then you said, now I'm going to do it at a different temperature with a different, you know, colon cancer cell line, you didn't get the same results. You wouldn't say, oh, those were bad results. You'd say that's a whole different experiment. The same thing is true here. I think that if you think ahead, what's the clinical question I'm asking? What's the context of use? And bind the data set to address that use. And prospectively, you're sure that that data set is clear. Again, the 21 gene recurrence score, I think, is a good example, where they started out and they asked a bunch of clinicians, what's your question? And we said, our question is, what do we do with node-negative, ER-positive patients who right now, if we calculate, we get about a 3 to 5% absolute benefit with chemotherapy. We know that that's, you know, if it's 1 or 2%, we won't treat them. If it's more than 6 or 7%, we will. They went to the NSABP. With B20, they developed the algorithm. They put about 300 genes into it. 16 came out, plus five standards. And then, with no monkey business with a lockdown assay, they went to B14, which had exactly the same question being asked. Again, node-negative, ER-positive patients receiving endocrine therapy, in both cases tamoxifen, and got almost identical results. And that's what's made some people convinced that this assay is real. Because
that's a very simplistic view of cancer. That's not an omic view of cancer in the sense that what you've taken are two relatively large biologically distinctive subpopulations and compared them. If you take an omic view of cancer, what you have is a continuum of diseases. And many of these relatively low frequency, low prevalence abnormalities are going to have an important impact on the way that some of these targeted therapeutics actually act. And so if you're going to talk about doing, you know, two comparative studies, you have to match across the entire aberrant ohm, and it's impossible.
So you're, you know, the argument I go back, you're making huge assumptions that you're right, and I don't know that you are. Okay, and I think omics needs to be boiled down to an assay that's actually clinically reasonable. You know, getting lucky is not a good strategy in golf or science. It always helps, but it's not a good prospective strategy.
I'm just saying that there are underlying properties in the ohm that you're not testing for when you set up a your new clinical trial, and just because it doesn't work doesn't make it wrong. It just means that you didn't get the match right. so you couldn't see the signal.
I think it's a matter of what claim you're trying to make. I mean, if you're trying to make a broad claim that this will work in ER-positive, no-negative patients, then if you try it on another set like that and it doesn't work, then you can't make that broad a claim. You could be absolutely right that there are other subtle biological differences between your original development set and your validation set that are the reason it doesn't work. But then you need to refocus your claim.
I mean, for example, if you make the claim that you're going to do whole genome sequencing because you're looking for BRAF mutations, and because you have a drug you think works in BRAF mutations, and you set up a prospective trial that has the kinds of consensus agreements we've all come to in terms of phase two, let's say it's a rare disease, and you're just not going to have enough patients to get to phase 3. But if prospectively you set that up and then you see what you said you're going to see, then I believe that. But if prospectively you just run a bunch of samples in a bunch of patients who were treated in all kinds of different ways, you're going to get lucky once. And you're going to get unlucky more often. At least that's what all the statisticians around the room have taught me.
Okay, Daniela?
Well, I just wanted to say, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the gold standard is always going to be validation on an external data set, and that's the only way to ever be totally sure. So in any study, we should have that before we're moving it into the clinic, right? But you're not just going to, by chance, get lucky and have something that happens to do well on an external data set if you didn't do the initial analysis that led to the development of that genomic signature properly. So a lot of Lisa's talk today was how can we properly do that initial analysis so that we aren't just blindly, by random chance, hoping to get something that works properly on external validation. Because the odds of that, when you're starting from 30,000 genes or 500,000 SNPs, are very, very slim. So we've got to do the science properly before we do the external validation.
Yeah, so you and I aren't here for a purpose. Let's discuss over lunch. Actually.
Right. Okay.
In fact, both of you are correct. Yeah. And as Daniela was just pointing out, you're correct. If we let's just go back to fundamental principles in developing drugs and biologics. What you want to do is you want to ultimately have something that's likely to work that you can validate in a phase 3 trial. And you want to follow through proper scientific process to maximize the likelihood that when you get to phase 3, it will in fact be positive. Here, as Daniela says, it's even more challenging because of the high level of multiplicity. So we need to follow these good practices to maximize. But ultimately, you do need to validate this in a proper clinical trial, because ultimately, even if you don't fully understand what the drug or biologic, what the mechanisms are, if it has a positive benefit to risk in phase 3, you've established benefit. Bonifoy was going to provide that, but it wasn't done with integrity. Any clinical trial that's validation must be done with integrity. So we actually need both. And it's the same thing I would have said if this were developing
the drug biologic. Here's Joe's argument, which is what a rule of Chan is trying to do at our center, and that is do whole genome sequencing and then try to focus patients in a phase 1 trial that might be more likely to work for them than just putting them into whatever trial is next. Mm-hmm. So I would argue, using historical controls, if we see a 20 or 30% response rate in phase 1s doing it that way, compared to historical controls where it's 5 to 10%, that suggests we're off to the races. But you still got to have a well-validated, analytically validated assay that's reproducible for each of the markers where you're putting the patients into those trials, because the current assay, I think, is going to make mistakes.
And still probabilistic.
Yeah, we're not too far apart.
Thank you all very much. Thank you especially, Lisa, and the team. We will break now. Please get your lunch. We'll resume discussing... The sort of the wrap-up of this whole discussion and where we go next.